Thank you all. It's always a joy to be here. And we're working with our book called The Power of Coincidence, How Life Shows Us What We Need to Know. And for this week, we were looking at chapters 6 and 7. 6 is on the conditions of our existence, and 7 is on dreams. So for the first half today, we'll talk about the givens of life, that is, the conditions of our existence. And then in the second half, we'll talk about dreams. And for next week, which is our final meeting, we have chapter 8 on spirituality and the epilogue. So that begins on 157. And can everybody see this way? So let's take a look at an important word for today, which is givens. There are some facts of life that we have no control over, and if we fight them tooth and nail, we will always feel uncomfortable, and we will continually fail. So some things are just to be greeted and given hospitality in our lives and accepted just as they are, with what Carl Jung calls an unconditional yes. Another way of describing the givens religiously would be God's will. God's will is whatever is. If we think of God as reality itself, then we notice that within reality there are conditions, givens, that we have no power to change. And the synchronicity comes in when we realize that these givens, even though they might seem so uncomfortable to us, actually help us. So when we say, "Thy will be done," we're actually saying, let what needs to happen happen, and somehow I will find a grace in every given that I accept. It's also summarized very well in that famous prayer by Reinhold Niebuhr, Lutheran theologian, written in 1943 during the war. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, wisdom to know the difference. So our topic today is, how do we find the serenity to accept the things we cannot change? And how are these things somehow full of grace? So the first one is the most obvious one. It's that everything in life will and is, will change and is continually changing. And everything eventually comes to an end. Things change and end. Everything is impermanent. It's not staying exactly as it is. One look in the mirror this morning made this very clear. And so if I'm trying to hang on to something and make sure that it never changes, I'm acting against the natural way of things. If everything is continually changing and ending, then the yes is to this transitory nature of all created things, all events, all relationships. And if it's like this here, it must be that there's something in going along with the program of letting the changes happen that ultimately will help us grow. So we're going to come back to that, and we're going to see how that works. But first, let's look at the five particular givens that I chose to work with. These are also in my book called The Five Things We Cannot Change. The second one is that things don't always go according to my plans. I'm certainly able to make plans, but I can't trust that what I want to have happen will happen. Or another way of saying it is, I'm not in control of very much, hardly anything, maybe nothing. Third, that we can't say that things will always work out fairly. Life is not always fair. It might be fair sometimes, but it's not always fair. Fourth, there's no way of escaping pain of some kind in the course of one's life, maybe not even daily. It will be physical pain, psychological, emotional, even spiritual, but somehow there will be suffering in the story of my life and of everyone. And finally, people are not always loyal and loving. Sometimes they are, and other times they're not. If I can say yes to these five, I'm going to have a serene and happier life than if I resent the fact that it's like this. Because when I look at these really closely, the first thing I notice is it's impossible for me to overturn them, to cancel them. But if I look even more carefully, I start to realize that these five are actually ingredients of a mature psychology and a mature spirituality. In other words, it was set up this way so that I could evolve. These are the, shall we say, handmaids of the impulse of evolution. Because if everything is changing and ending, then I'm evolving all the time, since evolution is precisely about things changing, some things ending, other things beginning. So it's change, end, begin, go through a particular series of changes, come out a new way. This happens over and over in the course of life. And it is the same thing that all the wonderful things in nature are doing too. So it has something to do, changing has something to do with the style of a journey. And since every one of us is geared to make some kind of journey through life, the changes help us get there. Secondly, if things don't go according to my plan, it might make me more conscious of a larger plan, sometimes called the divine plan, which is working itself out through various synchronous events. And if things are not always fair, I can say yes to that, and I can make a commitment to a spiritual practice that I will act fairly no matter what anybody else does. So I come up with a commitment to the virtue of justice. How did I get there? By the synchronous connection between not liking how unfair some people are or some things turn out to be, and saying to myself, but I don't have to do this. I can have another style. I can be in the world as one who wants to be fair all the time, or as much of the time as possible. And another part of the synchronicity, which I'll come back to, but I'll just mention now in passing, is that for every one of these alternatives, so I accept change as part of the journey, as part of the evolution. I notice that my plans don't work out, but I trust that there's a larger plan at work, what we've mentioned before. Something, we know not what, is always at work, trying to make us more than we are now, trying to make the world more than it is yet. I choose justice when I notice unfairness. What helped me with each of these is grace. Or another way of saying it is, there's a synchronicity, a similarity between each of the conditions of life and the graces we receive from the Holy Spirit. We receive graces to handle a world of changes, handle plans falling through, and so forth. There's pain in the world. There's pain in me. And as a spiritual practice, I can work with the pain in such a way, or work with the suffering in such a way, that I accept the part of it that I have no control over, and I engage in the spiritual practice of being compassionate toward those who suffer as I do, or even differently. So the fact of suffering awakens in me a caring about other people who suffer the same way. It would even affect your prayer life. Let's say you receive news from the doctor that you now have this possibly fatal disease, and you're praying, oh God, please heal me from this disease, or help me accept it and work through it, and help me find some form of healing deep down in myself if I can't heal the disease itself. Then you would add to your prayer, and I offer this same prayer for all the people on the planet who receive the same news I did today. See, suddenly you're expanding, so it's not just about you. And how did this happen? Something about the suffering opened me to care about others who are in the same boat. And finally, we notice that people are not loyal and loving. This one's very easy. We simply say, no matter how other people are toward me or toward each other, I'm asking for the grace to be loyal and loving anyway toward them. This would be the end of retaliation. You're disloyal to me, so I'll be disloyal to you. Changes to, no, I've made my own personal commitment based on my own integrity, and I've chosen to be loyal and loving to others no matter how they treat me. something like the Sermon on the Mount. Be good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who abuse you. It's a whole different style from do as you've been done by. So when I'm in a world of changes and I place the changes in the context of my ongoing development and the continuation of my journey, I have found how the changes are part of the makeup, the ingredients of spiritual progress, psychological growth, and all the way down the list. When the failure of my plans reminds me that I need to be humble and accept the fact that I'm not in control and look for some larger plan at work, I have moved in a spiritual direction. When things are unfair, people are not loyal and loving, I make the commitment to act differently. When I experience suffering, I grow in compassion for others, and I find a redemptive power in my suffering. Then it's all come together. There's a correspondence between the way things are here on this planet and the way we evolve here on the planet. We didn't get a chance to say yes to these givens before we came into the world. We just noticed them. And at first we tried to fight them. And then gradually we said, oh, I guess you just have to go along with the program. And if this is the program, and this is the meaning of the virtue of hope, if this is the program here, it must be that this is exactly what I need if I'm ever going to become my full self. This must be the right place to become a saint. What is a saint? One who has so said yes to these givens that he or she has been moved in the direction of turning them into forms of fuller consciousness and service to others. And for everyone, so I'll go back to the idea of the grace. Grace is a special help that comes to you without having to be merited, and we can trust that this grace is available to all of us. We have the grace to say yes to all of these. And by the way, saying that these are ingredients for how to become a full human is one who has depth, character, and compassion. These five are the pathways to those three. When I accept these, I notice I have more character, I have more depth, and I certainly have more compassion for all the other people in the world who are operating under the same five givens. Of course, there are thousands of givens, but I'm just choosing the five that most of us see almost every day. For instance, a simple given is living here, it's a given that there might be an earthquake. Whereas when I lived in Connecticut, there was not a given that there might be an earthquake, but there was a given that there might be hurricanes. Follow what I mean? Now, if you're fighting it, if you're saying, I don't want that to happen, then you're kind of missing the point that, you know, when you chose to come here, you automatically said yes to all the givens that go with being here. Now, apply that to human life. When you decided to go on living as a human, then it was the equivalent of an implicit acceptance of these givens. But the wonderful thing is we don't have to look at them as punishments because of some original sin. We can look at them as gifts that are challenges at the same time. Everybody follow? And of all the practices I've ever done, I can say without the slightest hesitation, nothing has helped me more than the unconditional yes. The total surrender to the way things are, total surrender to reality, also called total yes to thy will be done. That's how the kingdom comes. Kingdom, thy kingdom come goes with thy will be done. What is this kingdom? A world of justice, peace, and love. How would we get there? By steps such as these. Questions about this or ideas? Everybody get the basic concept? Barbara, you want to come up to the... You want to come up to the microphone? Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Thy will be done is the first step toward thy kingdom come. Okay, Dennis has a question, then Gordon. Or a comment.
It seems to me that when we use these words, thy will be done, we're sort of invoking the archetype of God as a loving parent. But if you had parents who were mixed up or unbalanced, it becomes like, I don't have that archetype to fall back on. So I fall back on a different archetype in order to say yes, which is to say, whatever happens, a billion years of evolution have prepared me to be creative. So therefore, I must not fight what's going on, but interact with it for the highest good of everybody using the resources that evolution or the universe has put inside of me. It's not quite as reassuring as the idea that there's a sort of loving rearranger, a loving arranger of my life journey who's always giving me just the lesson that I need. But I think, I mean, for some people that really is available and I bless them, but for some it isn't.
Yeah. And you're reminding us that a perfect example of a given would be our childhood. We can't go back and change it. But we can work with it so that somehow we grow because of it. That would be the equivalent of it came in with a grace. Gordon?
The Hindus and the Buddhists have an interesting idea about fairness with the reincarnation and karma, in that if some things don't happen right in this life, they're going to be corrected in the next one, possibly. But then we don't know that for sure. But it's a comforting belief if you're willing to believe that sort of thing, which I am. But it makes sense anyway. And then they say, another saying is, the mills of the gods grind slowly, but they grind exceedingly fine. Niles found that interesting.
I'm glad you brought that up about the fairness, because it does remind me. The ego, shall we say the arrogant ego, the inflated ego, that wants to be in full control, the part of us that believes ourselves entitled to special treatment. What is special treatment? I'm exempt from givens like these, because I'm a big shot. Well, how are the mighty fallen would be the response to that. But when you hold the belief that all those people who were unfair to you will someday be punished, either in this life or in the next, through karma or at the last judgment, you have to ask yourself, is this my own ego whose favorite sport is revenge? Is that what I'm trying to do? Have I even commandeered a faith belief so that it would serve my ego's need to get back at those who have hurt me? We would want to let go of that. We wouldn't want to carry that around inside. It's not a very spiritual perspective. It comes from the most primitive part of us. So the style of nonviolence toward those who have hurt us, the Sermon on the Mount, do good to those who hate you, gives us an alternative. Hi, Renee.
Hi. Just looking at the story of Joseph. His father made him a dream coat, and his brothers decided to kill him, but they were merciful and sold him into slavery. Okay. And then he was falsely accused and put in prison. And then he became the second highest leader of Egypt. And how he paid his brothers back for their evil was to welcome them, to feed them, to take care of them, just to be this loving, non-revengeful brother.
What a beautiful example.
I know, isn't that?
Yes.
Thank you.
It's one of my favorite stories. And remember what Joseph said when he was with his brothers and they thought that he was going to take revenge upon them. He said, "No, what you intended for evil, God has turned into good." Isn't that beautiful? And, of course, no matter what, we could make that commitment that I'm going to repay good whether I receive evil or not. That would be a highly spiritual style for us. Other questions about this? Yeah, so you want to come on up here? Hi. Nice to see you. How have you been?
I wanted to just take this opportunity. I'm always a little confused when I come across the idea. There is not our innate morality at play in the broader cosmos, in that it's not moralistic in that sense of the word that we understand it to be, where it's judging good and evil constantly, and probably something to do with this transformative power of, you know, the bad, the potentiality there, but. Do you have any thoughts about that where morality plays into the broader universal energy?
Well, I was thinking of that as you were bringing that up. I was thinking of Martin Luther King's statement about, you know, there's evil in the world, but the arc of our history is going toward justice. So, the virtue of hope is about trusting that evil will never have the last word, that somehow more and more goodness will show itself in the world. And, of course, that would also tell us our calling. Oh, so I'm here to bring more goodness into the world. And, it isn't set up that this whole universe and humanity can be relied upon to act morally. It would be up to each of us to take a stand in that way. It's hard to answer that question because it contains an important given, which is that there is something neutral about the way things are playing out, and it isn't as if we can always trust that in each instance everything will, quote, work out just as we want it to. Sometimes it doesn't work out as we want to. the promise is not things will work out perfectly or the way we want them to or all for the best each time. The promise is, no matter how things work out, you will always have the grace to work with it in such a way that you grow from it and somehow make a contribution to co-create a world of justice, peace, and love. That's the promise. Not it'll always happen the way we ultimately want it to, but no matter what happens, gives us an opportunity for spiritual practice. In that sense, if someone in a relationship to you betrays you, given that people are not always loyal, the betrayal itself is somehow a trigger to face the fact that people betray and step up to the challenge not to betray them in turn, but to handle the grief that you feel and not retaliate against the one who hurt you. It has all that in it, and that's why whatever happens, somehow that's what's meant by everything that happens is for the best. Not that it comes out in the best way that you want, but that you can make the best of it. And all our spiritual practices and psychological work help us get there. So settling into reality this way makes a big difference in how you walk around in the world as a full adult. So another thing about all these, I don't know if you've noticed, but every one of them is somehow a loss that leads to grief. So another reason that we fight these givens is that we don't want to experience one of the most difficult of all the human feelings, which is grief, sadness. Every one of these has grief in it somewhere. When something ends, you're going to be sad. Plans didn't work out. Things aren't fair. Pain is happening. People are not loyal and loving all the time. Every one of them contains the challenge to be sad, to be angry, to be afraid. The kind of feelings that deepen us. Kind of feelings that awaken us to the bold, hard facts of reality. And we don't like going there, and understandably so. But it's certainly meaningful that Jesus and Mary both endured such suffering. And they seem to, they're not only the model for what you look like when you accept suffering, they also are present in our lives as grace givers, so that we could endure our version of suffering during our lifetime. I'm a total believer in that. This is how our spiritual resources ultimately help us. Other questions about this? It's a very fascinating topic, isn't it? It really is. And if these givens of life are true for all of us, then it also creates community, because you're noticing that all of us, every single person in this room and in all rooms, have noticed that the truth of these. And it just gives us the feeling of some kind of togetherness. So it isn't just a personal journey, it's also a collective one.
I think I get it, but...
Okay.
when do we stand up? When do we become the change that needs to happen and not take it anymore?
Okay. So she's bringing up the important point of it's the courage to change the things we can. And of course you would need a lot of wisdom to know the difference. So I'll do all I can to have something work, and then at a certain point I just have to say yes. And let it be what it is. So your first step is always, well, what can I do here that will amend the situation, that will help me make sense of it and change it in such a way that things work out a lot better? You put all the energy you can into that, and then at a certain point you can say, oh, okay, I guess I've gone as far as I can go. And now it's time to say yes to the way it's going to be. So we're always keeping in mind that we're still going to do all we can to make the changes and be the change that needs to happen in the world, while at the same time we are going to accept the fact that some things change just this much, but not all the way. Does this make sense to everybody? It's just the other side of the coin. Hi, Lee.
This whole conversation reminds me of a quip I heard years ago. It said you can learn a lot about a person by observing how they handle lost airline luggage, a rained out vacation, and tangled Christmas tree lights.
Very good example. I wanted to read just a short, something brief here on page 113. Religion is designed to respond to the givens of existence. It could be that religion came about because of the givens. People noticed these givens and thought to themselves, I don't like this arrangement. There must be another world somewhere where it's all different. Religion is designed to respond to the givens. There's a consolation in the belief that the immediate experience that we're having is not the whole reality. That does make sense. But religion could be used to shield us from the full brunt of life's conditions. You know, the woman in 1930... whose husband was a horribly violent alcoholic, beating her and her children. And she went to the priest, and the priest said, oh, just offer your sufferings up. Just, you know, try to make the best of it. That was not really helpful. Promising repeal in this life or in the next. An adult with faith trusts a divine providence and protection, but not as a shield from life's conditions. He trusts that no matter what may happen, he will still be surrounded by grace, especially the grace to go on loving. This is how divine providence is real, A person of faith has to ask himself if he seeks the consolations of God or the God of all consolation, who sometimes does not console, but allows him to feel the givens baldly and boldly. Give me the grace to accept the givens boldly, to let the chips fall where they may, and make the best of how they fell. That would be the equivalent of, I'm sitting in the saddle in the direction the horse is going, instead of opposite. And I have my quotation here from Mircea Eliade, who, in talking about the hero, remember we talked about the journey through life, so it's a heroic journey. What does hero mean? One who has lived through pain, been transformed by it, and helped others because of it. That's the hero. And Eliade says, the law of life lives in him with his unreserved consent. He accepts he battles the dragon, he does all the brave things that a hero is called upon to do. But at the end, he accepts with unreserved consent the way things turn out to be. And that includes everything from childhood to what was on the news yesterday. So I'm still doing all I can to make this a better world, make myself a better person. But part of the calling that was given to all of us is more than that. It's to say yes to what eludes our grasp, what does not change no matter what we do. So in other words, to reality itself. Hi, Jane. So let's have another question and then we'll start winding up.
Is there a time when no means yes?
Do you want to give an example?
Yes. I could probably give you a lot, but a more serious one. A marriage where, all right, we'll pick on the man. Could be the woman is the bad acting character. And it's just come to the point where you can't take it anymore. And isn't that a no to the way it is?
Mm. So yeah, it's a no to putting up with it any longer and a yes to taking care of myself.
So no is an important part of this.
Yes. Well, that is a good point, that sometimes it'll have the, you'll hear the sound of a no, but that's really a yes. I'm glad you brought that up, Jane, because otherwise we would take it too literally. Father Larry, you wanted to come up for a minute? Yeah.
First of all, I just wanted to say, David, it's such a joy. It's such a gift to be in your presence and
to feel
and to sense the wisdom, the grace, the love, the peace that comes forth from you. So thank you. And just such a joy to be here. I'm sorry I don't get here as much as I would like. I think I'm too busy. Dave asked me if I just had any thoughts, and I'd just like to share a couple of thoughts I had. Of course, we all love the beautiful prayer, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And for me this morning, you brought that into a little bit different light that I really appreciated in terms of the givens and these aspects of our lives that, you know, are can be moments of challenge, but certainly in grace are moments of serenity. And for me, I really love the way you pointed out. I think sometimes in saying that prayer, I kind of pass over the wisdom piece of it. You know, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and then that wisdom. But it's wisdom that drives us and draws us into this aspects of all of this. So thank you for that. That's such a gift. I wanted to invite you to this Saturday at Old Mission Santa Barbara at the Bonaventure Room. On Saturday morning, starting at 8:30 to noon, we are having a presentation. I work with the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. I'm sure some of you know that. And I have a personal strong stance about nuclear weapons and the disarmament of nuclear weapons. And so we're putting together a lecture on Saturday with a young man named Paul Chappell. Paul Chappell is a West Point graduate, young man. He's probably in his mid-30s. Graduated in West Point, served in Iraq as a military officer, as an army officer, and then came to the realizations of the inconsistencies that he felt and the trauma, basically the trauma that he felt through all of this, and has taken a strong, active stance specifically against any kind of trauma, but specifically also against nuclear weapons. So we are going to be offering this presentation. He's going to be giving his talk. He's Korean and Anglo, so he kind of has racial issues that he's... and he grew up in Alabama, yes. So. So I would like to invite you to this. So he'll be giving a talk on his experience. I'll be giving a talk from the Franciscan point of view, the Franciscan spirituality of how we address trauma, hopefully. I also wanted to call to mind that today is the 11th anniversary of the passing of Father Virgil. Alice just told me yesterday. So we remember him with great devotions,
yeah,
and great appreciation. The last thing I wanted to mention, this is more of a classical thing, but we were talking about the cross, and I mean how we accept these things that are inconsistent and how they, you know, impede our life. I heard a little thing yesterday that kind of really enlightened me. Excuse me for saying this, but you know the beautiful or the song. I love Bob Dylan, first of all. I'm sure you all do. But he has a song. I don't know the name of the song, but they stole me in the morning, they stole me in the evening, they stole me when the sun goes down. You know that song? I always thought that referred to that he was getting high. It's not. Do you know what his reference is? He's talking about a physical stoning, like St. Paul or someone who is stoned for something that they stand up for. That he's standing up and he says that they're stoning me for this. So that was an incredible revelation that, you know, of coming from that man. So,
and that's sometimes the given.
And that's the given. That, yeah. Exactly, David. Isn't that? That's the given that you're stoning me.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dave, for letting me share
my
thoughts.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Father.
I was thinking when we were talking about revenge, what Michelle said about when they go low, we go high.
Yes.
That's one thing. The other thing is, after last week's class, I got to thinking about how when unexpected things happen, over time, I have begun to trust those things more than my own plans. That they seem to work out for the better. Those coincidences, like even simple things, like when there was parking there, I used to say, "Well, I'll go to the library if there's parking right in front." So then there wouldn't be parking right in front. So I would go somewhere else, and I'd run into someone that I hadn't seen in a long time or had something special to share with me. So those kinds of things just seem to happen for the better than what I would have done otherwise.
Thank you, Christine. Anybody else have anything left over from before? And I also forgot to mention a wonderful quotation that means so much to me from 2 Corinthians, St. Paul speaking about Jesus, and he says, In him, there was only yes. What a beautiful way to live. In him, there was only yes. Yeah, hi.
Yes, I'm finding this topic really pertinent to my own life because I'm finding this topic extremely pertinent to what has been weighing on me so heavily, and that is just the unbelievable injustice and cruelty that I am personally not experiencing, but what I know, and I don't feel I can close my ears and shut my eyes, is happening in the entire world. And do you have any specific, like, suggestions for techniques to somehow feel like whatever little bit you're doing is enough to the point where it doesn't keep you awake at night with rage and just sadness and frustration?
It would be that same prayer that we've been talking about. And the prayer reminds us of the given of our limits. That there are certain things that I can't change, and I ask for the serenity to accept them, and I'm asking for the courage to change the ones I can. And when you keep going back to that prayer, it helps you settle into your limitations and the bigness of your calling. So I find it very helpful. So that's my main way of working with. I understand what you're saying. Seems like just a drop in the bucket, anything we do, compared to the gigantic problems we're facing. But all we can do is what's right in front of us in our particular little life as a challenge. We can just pick up whatever that little challenge is. So, thank you. Sounds like what they're offering at the mission on Saturday is a good example of how do you work with such something so gigantic as nuclear weapons and, you know, make some contribution to a change. And we're never forgetting that there's a powerful Pentecostal spirit, a fiery spirit, the Holy Spirit, that is with us on this path toward justice, toward peace, and toward love. Like, it's not all about us. There's something else that's supporting us in our work.
Thank you for your words of wisdom. You've really reframed the Serenity Prayer so beautifully for all of us, I think. I just wanted to mention this morning another little synchronicity happened.
Sit a little closer to the microphone.
A little synchronicity happened with me. I pulled up the graduation speech. Viola Davis, if you know who she is, she spoke at Barnard on Monday, and it was the most beautiful, beautiful talk. She quoted Thomas Merton. She quoted Joseph Campbell, and she talked about the need for us to own it, to own our history, to own our grief, to own our poverty, and to bring with it to our work in the world. And her final words, and if I can find them here, it's that you can either leave something for people or you can leave something in people. And I think it's such, so beautifully said. So I would encourage you to try to pull that up. You can find it on YouTube, I think.
Well, thank you. So let's take a look at the next part of our topic. Obviously, there's a wonderful correspondence or synchronicity between what we experience in a dream during the night and the journey that we're on during the day. because there's a larger intelligence inside of us, something more expansive than our ego, what Jung called the self with a capital S, or you could call it higher self or higher power. I'm thinking of that quotation in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We found an unsuspected resource that turned out to be within us. We found an unexpected resource within us that turned out to be the same as the higher power. Talk about a wisdom realization. That is one. So there's something in us. It's a divine spark, and it lights up the night with certain stories and images that come to us in dreams. And if we work with the dreams, and I'll be giving some examples of how to do that, and you saw a lot of this in your chapter, we, shall we say, dream the dream onward into conscious life. That's the Jungian suggestion. So you take the characters that you met up with in the dream as pieces of yourself. Each one of them represents a part of you that you may not have paid enough attention to in the course of your daily round. And they come in at night to remind you of their presence. So if we were to think of the psyche as a process rather than a thing, it's a process by which apparent contradictions are meant to embrace each other and work with each other to bring up a third possibility that's bigger than both and that somehow helps us and helps the world around us. And Jung called this the transcendent function of the psyche. It's the part of us that knows how to bring together what seem to be contradictory elements in ourselves. For instance, part of ourselves is kind and gracious and generous and good. Another part of ourselves is greedy and not so good. And so you could think of those in a binary way and think of them as two polarities, or you can notice that your psyche has the power to bring together apparently disparate characteristics of yourself and mix them up in a way that brings up an entirely new alternative, wonderfully surprising and wonderfully healthy. So we're trying to figure out how dreams help us do that. So I'll just start with this quotation on page 142 of our book. Dreams are visions from a superior intelligence inside ourselves and all around us, that points out our ego's blind spots and challenges us to deal with them. Dreams come from a knowledge larger than our ego or our IQ, and they tell us what we don't yet know. In the prayer, give me the wisdom to know the difference. The wisdom comes in dreams often. Even in the story of St. Paul, when he's converted on the road to Damascus, then the person that he's going to talk to, Ananias, has a dream about this event, about the fact that he's being converted. So sometimes dreams tell you what you don't know yet, and sometimes they remind you that you've become too one-sided and you're not paying attention to a side of yourself that you have denied or disavowed or repressed, what Jung called the shadow side. When you dream of a person doing something that's obviously aggressive, evil, wicked, and you're thinking to yourself, oh, what's wrong with me? Why would I have a dream like that? You're actually hearing from a side of you that you just can't even believe is in you. But actually, every single thing that humans can do, any of us can do. There's a line from a ancient Roman, classical Roman poet, Terence. Nothing human is alien from me. Anything humans can do, I can do. So the dream shows you this, shall we say, more extended vision of yourself. And sometimes the dreams can even foretell the future, because in your unconscious mind, there is no sequential time. In our conscious life, we have past, present, and future. Present is sandwiched between past and future. But in the unconscious, in the larger part of ourselves, because Freud uses the analogy of the iceberg, tip of the iceberg, that's our conscious life. The whole rest of the iceberg is our unconscious. It's much, much larger than anything in our ordinary awareness. And in this unconscious world inside of us are all the realizations that are waiting to come up to the surface. But in order to do this, they have to cut across time and even defy time. So at an unconscious level, you're still 5 years old, 6 years old, and so forth. Whereas in conscious life, you're as old as your birth certificate dictates. So this is a quote from Jung, and I'm on page 145. Dreams prepare, announce, or warn about situations long before they happen. Because in the unconscious, they have already happened, since there is no separation between past and future, or present and future. This is not a miracle or precognition. Most crises have a long incubation in the unconscious. We talked about some of that last time, the idea of the timing. I gave the quote from Shakespeare. There are many events in the womb of time that wait to be delivered. So conception of something has already happened silently, like actual conceptions. Something has silently happened within that is gearing us in a certain direction, and the inner superior intelligence of the unconscious already knows about it. And so you're going to dream about something that is going to happen in the future, as if it were happening right there that night. And sometimes sometimes what's waiting to happen is happening in a circumstance that's the exact opposite of the conventional event that's occurring. I'll give a simple example. Let's say your psyche, your superior intelligence, knows that you need time alone, a long retreat from the workaday world so that you can reconnect with your inner resources and you can be alone enough so that you catch on to something inside yourself that's waiting to come to the surface. But that's happening on your wedding day. So it looks like, oh, this is the time to be with somebody 24/7. But actually, at another more important level, this is the time not to be with someone. So you're always going to feel uneasy because you did the conventional thing, whereas actually something else was taking shape inside you. So you're always going to feel a little out of place because here you are embarking on something that doesn't match what is meant to happen next for you. That would be another example of I need the wisdom to know the difference. But a dream will point it out. So, of course, it's going to be important to remember dreams. And I have my list here in the book starting on 145. Most people say, oh, I can't remember my dreams. That's understandable because dreams go into the short-term memory. So we even forget them in 1 second. You could wake up thinking of a dream and 1 second later you've totally forgot it because it's very short term. So you would want to keep a pad and pen or a recorder by the bed and, you know, just jot down or say the main points of the dream. You don't have to write it out fully, just give the main points. For instance, if I said, wicked stepmother, princess, seven dwarfs, if I just wrote those three things down, I could fill in the entire story. And the same thing will happen with dreams. Throughout the day, you could use an affirmation like, I'm remembering my dreams now. Helps to wake up naturally without an alarm clock. As you awaken, you can keep your eyes closed so that you won't be distracted by what you might see in the room. And you want to drop the need for any explanation. You just want to have it all make sense. Be okay whether it makes sense or not, but let's put it that way. And most important, you would take the part of each of the characters in the dream and you would write out or say whatever they might say. So if you dreamed of yourself in a forest and a wolf approached you and you woke up suddenly because it was scary, that's the equivalent of a nightmare, a dream from which you awake in fear. Instead of just trying to cancel it out, you would have the wolf talk to you. You approached me, tell me what you want of me. What are you asking of me? So you're asking the wolf to say something. Then you switch and become the wolf, and you speak to yourself in the wolf's voice. Because the wolf is in the dream as a part of yourself that is looking for some kind of attention. Animals in dreams, by the way, I'm on the bottom of 148. Animals in a dream are often guides to the rich deposits in the unconscious mind. In your pondering on their appearance in your dream, follow them. Remember Alice, follow White Rabbit, down into the unconscious world, where everything is very different from up here. Alice found a new world when she followed the White Rabbit. Dorothy found her power to get home when she followed Toto, who had jumped out of the dirigible. In fact, Jung also says, when you become spiritual, an animal will appear. On 149, so you want to beware of your judgments about your dreams, such as, I had a bad dream. There are no bad dreams. Bad shows something that's unlived or unacknowledged and been repressed, and you're ready to make friends with it. You're finding out not how bad you are, but how badly some part of you wants to be confronted and dealt with. It's not a bad dream, it's how badly it wants to make contact. And you ask what that may be, no longer afraid of knowing. Another judgment might be, I must be a terrible person because I have such evil things in me, and that's why I had such a terrible dream. That is not true either, since all of us contain all the images of all mankind. Remember the Christmas carol, O little town of Bethlehem. Yet in thy dark streets shineth the everlasting light. So no matter how dark the streets are, with somewhere there, there's an everlasting light. Everlasting shows that it's spiritual, since the opposite of the given of life, that nothing is everlasting. So there's a creative kernel in every dark image, a potential for light and goodness. And it appears when we stop seeing ourselves as bad, but look for the valuable kernel. K-E-R-N-E-L. Not Colonel Sanders. And I have my quote from Joseph Campbell, because I also want to distinguish between a personal dream. So you have a dream about something happening in your ordinary daily life or some family member. But some dreams are archetypal. Joseph Campbell describes these. Dreams point to a higher potential health, not simply past or present crises, giving clues to the archetypes of the psyche that are pressing for recognition. Archetypes are recurrent themes that appear as images in our dream life or in art, or they're also characters in stories the world over. So all over the world and in all centuries, there have been stories of a king, a queen, a mother, a father, a brother, a sister, a guide, a villain, a hero, a trickster. All of those energies are inside all of us, and some dreams come from that corridor. You'll know it when it happens because it'll be very powerful and you can't forget it. It doesn't go into the short-term memory because then it's the long-term. And you have a feeling of something mystical happening. Or another way of saying it is, you have broken through the barrier between the finite and the infinite, between the timely and the timeless. That would be the equivalent of a mystical realization. These archetypal dreams especially occur during a time of crisis. You're going through some terrible thing, and you'll have this kind of a dream. And I say on 152, they herald a transition, a time when a new strength is ready to surface, or a new attitude is required to meet new challenges. Oracular, ego-transcending wisdom of the archetypal self emerges from deep in the psyche. The priestess at the Apollo, at the shrine of Apollo at Delphi, gave answers to questions. Answers came from the higher intelligence. Where is this higher intelligence? Deep in nature. the priestess was underground, and the priest could look down and see her, and she gave answers. She's always been sitting here beside us, but we've never traveled far enough within to consult her. Archetypal dreams are emitted from deep in nature where she sits, and they speak to us in her now ready to be audible voice. At a certain point, the wisdom inside, which is the wisdom of the Holy Spirit, wants to come through, and it can no longer be silenced. Thinking of this wonderful statement by Richard Rohr, he says, you have found inner silence when the silence silences you. Questions about this part? Okay, Jackie. So we'll just have Jackie's comment, and then we're going to wind up because our time is about up.
I have two things to say, if you don't mind, because they're sort of different. Yeah. One of them was concerning my son, who had sleep apnea very severely, and he has a machine now in which he now sleeps properly. And he was told by the doctor, he said, when you have this apnea, you don't dream. You're not in that REM state. He said, but your dreams are backed up inside you. He said, so don't worry about it. You will have a whole succession of, and possibly very strange dreams. And he did.
Interesting.
So do you suppose our dreams are just waiting for us to dream them? Just waiting for the right time to come out?
Yeah. Yeah,
that's a very strange thing. And the other thing I was going to say is, on fairly often, I dream I am somebody else. Now, I know you're going to say it's all me, but I was wondering, could I step into somebody else's dream by accident? The reason I know it's not me is while I am dreaming and being this person that is not me, I'm also watching the dream. And I'm looking at this person who doesn't look anything like me. I'm wondering what's going on. Sometimes I'm a man.
Hmm.
And they're just little stories that don't seem to have any particular consequence, but they do have rational stories behind them.
Yeah.
And I'm watching them, but I'm also being them.
Mm-hmm. I think we can all relate to what you're saying.
So I just wondered if it's possible to pull into somebody else's dream. Odd thought, isn't it?
Yeah. I'll have to give that some thought. I don't know. But, yeah, since we're all connected, it probably does make sense. Well, I'd like to end with this poem by Thomas Moore, an Irish poet. And it has to do with our original topic having about the changes. And this is his sonnet written to his lady love. And you'll see the relevance of it. It also has been turned into a song. Believe me if all those endearing young charms which I gaze on so fondly today were to change by tomorrow and fleet in my arms like fairy gifts fading away, thou wouldst still be adored as this moment thou art. Let thy loveliness fade as it will. And around the dear ruin, each wish of my heart would entwine itself verdantly still. It is not while beauty and wealth are thine own, and thy cheek unprofaned by a tear, that the fervor and faith of a heart may be known, to which time will but make thee more dear. For the heart that has truly loved never forgets, but as truly loves on to the close, as the sunflower turns to her God when he sets. The same look that she turned when he rose. Thank you all.